We typed O and asked, do you see the O? And they said yes. Then we typed G and the system crashed. The first link between the California and Stanford universities was set up. It was a success. The network was invented. He said the complicated receivers and processors were secretly transferred in special diplomatic packages and bags to the embassies and were used for surveillance after being installed.
See that structure at the top that looks something like an Indian teepee with the little lightning rods on top? I watched them build that. I watched them construct it.
Duncan Campbell confirmed his claims. The tools in the U.S. embassies in Geneva and Berlin were of the same type. This part of Echelon was named the stateroom. Echelon services were improving by the day, and Mike Frost had more to reveal. As ordered by Margaret Thatcher, Echelon was used to spy on two UK cabinet members as well. Echelon's footprints could be traced in Princess Diana's death and the Mossad's revenge against the Munich incident. In 2000, James Woolsey, the CIA director, asserted that because of financial concerns, Echelon was involved in spying on industries and business as well. It led to big agreements by Boeing, which made European companies and experts lose jobs. The U.S. was stealing the Europeans' jobs as well.
That America was stealing European jobs.
A European delegation took a trip to Washington, but the U.S. canceled all meetings and the committee had to cut the trip short. The U.S. refused to answer the demands. On September 11th, 2001, something extraordinary happened. Two planes crashed into the World Trade Center Twin Towers. Everyone was speechless and emotional. No one saw the tower's engineered collapse. The Western media mobilized the international community. The perpetrators should have been arrested and executed. Because of such incidents, people would be under surveillance along with the terrorists. Everyone forgot how Echelon abused the circumstances. Echelon was unbelievably tasked with fighting terrorism. The war on terror started. After a while, the U.S. tried to form a coalition to launch an invasion on Iraq. Before that, Western officials considered Echelon's services meager and insignificant. But when Colin Powell sought to compel the U.S. Security Council members to launch an attack on Iraq by unveiling the conversation between Iraqi Ba'athist commanders about hiding chemical weapons, Echelon's unbelievable capabilities to record conversations came to light. The conversations could be converted into text. Echelon was higher than what was said. In 2003, the U.S. invaded Iraq, which led to the massacre of people. Julian Assange made a disclosure. After founding WikiLeaks, he took refuge in the Ecuadorian embassy. The number of whistleblowers gradually increased. On June 5, 2013, young engineer Edward Snowden, who worked in the intelligence company Booz Allen Hamilton as a security contractor of the Defense Department, in an interview made a huge revelation. The NSA had launched a large-scale surveillance program on everything, even social networks. The internet was not safe.
Targets the communications of everyone.
He proved that the security cooperation between Western countries amid the Cold War contained the most secret mysteries in the West. Protect America Act of 2007 led to the creation of a secret program, a program to gather two types of data: metadata and content from all conversations. The program was called PRISM. The conspiracy theory collapsed. There was a real plot going on. Google, which was the main research engine for many people to search, watch videos, and send emails, was at the heart of PRISM. All of the information and activities by users on the internet was recorded, and the NSA astonishingly had direct access to the data by Google and other internet giants like Facebook, Apple, Yahoo, and even small companies. It would easily save the data. The agency had worked a miracle. The coding software had become an agent of spying. For example, journalists used Tor software to hide their own identities. They were supposed to use Tor to not be tracked so their identities wouldn't be revealed, but that didn't happen. There was a big lie. Everything was right in front of the agency's organization. Only 10% of the internet was used by ordinary people, and the remaining 90% was being controlled by the NSA. Snowden disclosed facts about Bull Run and Q-Score. The programs were used for coding telecommunication and online data. They had a budget of $800 million. The situation was chaotic, and the issue was taken to the Senate. James Clapper was grilled in the Senate meeting. He was questioned if the NSA had recorded any information on U.S. citizens. Clapper said no. He was dismissed for wrong testimony. Things were even worse in Britain. Even though the UK intelligence agency had a system to identify coded telecommunication through cable networks, it was intensely after influencing Hotmail, Google, Yahoo, and Facebook. Their espionage program was Tempora, which started in 2008 and became operational in 2011. The other program was Edge Hill. These programs had unique features. They worked with advanced mathematical techniques. For example, Edge Hill, that cost $250 million a year, could crack emails, bank documents, and medical documents. It could penetrate VPNs and secure layers and was trying to penetrate 4G smartphones. This program would damage facilities on purpose. The software was really dangerous. Why were the facilities so vulnerable? According to U.S. laws, the companies were forced to send their products to the agency to test them for supervision. The NSA and the CIA would change the design and make the facility sent by the companies traceable and would turn them into spy tools. The NSA was seeking to carry on with its surveillance activities through free hubs and Wi-Fis, just like GPS devices. Verizon wireless software, with 100 million users, was also used as spyware. The documents showed that the agency had penetrated international standards that stress coding systems and had caused weaknesses in security standards. Snowden struck the coup de grace on the concept of standards and information technology. The NSA influenced international standards that encryption systems relied on, working covertly in 2006 to get its own version of draft security standards issued by National Institute of Standards and Technology, the NIST, and approved for worldwide use. Standard was at the service of the NSA. It was as if everyone was trying to take over in the espionage race. The FBI and CIA were well aware of the weaknesses of smart systems, but they wouldn't say anything about it for espionage purposes. They were taking advantage of the vulnerabilities.
I feel terrible about what happened to these Iraqi detainees.
I'd do it again in a minute.
George Bush's operation to get revenge for the 9/11 attacks started with widespread espionage activities. The basis for the espionage was the internet, but it wasn't the whole plan to get revenge. The U.S. was thirsty for power.
Either you are with us, or you are with the terrorists.
The slogan, either you're with us or against us, led to the occupation of Iraq and Afghanistan. The ground was paved for international intranets. The coalition of eyes was formed. The information was classified and was provided only in a limited amount after receiving guarantees. The game had started. After a year, a 27-terabyte database was built in the Bagram Air Base data center that would save regional information. The Polish soldiers who were deployed in Afghanistan went to distant and tough terrains the U.S. troops wouldn't go. They received a tracking device in return for their favor and tried to help the U.S. more. But they weren't allowed to join the intelligence coalition in Afghanistan. Poland, along with several other NATO member states, was on the red list. The English-speaking countries that had historical and cultural roots in English islands had closer cooperation with each other compared to other countries, even in the occupation of Afghanistan. The coalition for Iraq was different. As they had to face a larger population, the agency rolled up its sleeves and simultaneously spied on 4 to 5 million Baghdad residents. The White House, the Defense Department, the FBI and CIA had their own intranets. Gradually, it came to light that the number of the networks was much higher than already disclosed. Finally, top secret intranets that could transfer sensitive SCI information were unveiled. Interlink and Intellipedia were special software for the agency staff to share information from all over the world. One of their favorite subjects was Iran's nuclear activities that led to the Stuxnet malware. The information also showed who was strongly against the invasion of Iraq and how different countries assessed their national information. In 2013, the CIA's budget to topple governments increased to $15 billion. The NSA, that was only assigned with digital operations, issued a bill of at least $10.5 billion. They claimed that their mission was to protect the United States security.
Necessary to do the job to protect the American people from further attack.
The heavy investment on the NSA helped it become so advanced that in 2018, it could spy on all smartphones and completely control people and all cell phones. No phone was safe.
Are not especially good in protecting your privacy. Think right now.
What the NSA does has to do with encryption. It is the biggest employer of mathematicians in the world, either directly or indirectly. The NSA owns the biggest supercomputers in the world. The minimum amount of electricity bill in its headquarters in Maryland is $21 billion. The NSA supervises all processes of transfer of information in any shape or form. That is, an email sent from a room to the adjacent room is done under the watchful eyes of the NSA. Where does the NSA's power come from? Administratively, the NSA belongs to the Defense Department and works under the supervision of the DNI. The NSA's director is at the same time head of the Central Security Service as well. The NSA is an expert in signal intelligence and provides services to other intelligence agencies. The basis for the NSA's widespread activities are telecommunications and national security acts. The Telecommunications Act was ratified in 1996. The act stems from a 1934 act that's still binding. The president has the authority to control all communication in case of a threat posed by war. It means he can shut down the internet. But the internet is formed based on the activities of companies that provide internet services that are known as the internet's spinal cord. In 2010, U.S. senators claimed the right and ownership to the internet so they could shut it down as and when they wished. They put it to a vote to register the internet as a national asset. The motion was repealed without being put to a vote. The reason was the direct and indirect benefits of the internet for the U.S. The internet was a source of revenue and widespread espionage, so it couldn't be specific to a country. The U.S. economy was dependent on the internet, the NSA, and DARPA. In this economic model, the circumstances should lead everyone to anxiously use the internet. The internet was the attractive factor that facilitated other plans. It worked as a catalyst. On the one hand, shutting down the internet would cause concern in other countries and make them create their own national networks to transfer data. And making those facilities in other countries would reduce the possibility for espionage. So the national networks shouldn't have been created by other countries, and people shouldn't use them under the slogan of the internet for all, so intelligence agencies could carry out their operations well. The U.S. spy agencies came into being according to the National Security Act and spread like wildfire. Soon, there were 17 main agencies and many more departments. The intelligence spending in the U.S. is provided under two programs, the National Intelligence Program and the Military Intelligence Program. The spending for the two programs increased from $72 billion in 2013 to about $86 billion in 2020. The officials behind the two programs and all other institutions were called the U.S. Intelligence Community, or the IC. The IC considers itself a federation of its own constituents. It sets the goals and priorities. It spends billions of dollars for different intelligence projects. Some programs are introduced as a 10-year espionage program, and some others are for longer periods. The IC power increased after the 80s, when analyzing data became a focal point, so it would help politicians by sifting through the information. In fact, it was discovering less expensive solutions to tackle America's problems. The information was fast increasing. Managing it was a tough challenge. The solution was investing on projects, the same policy that led to the creation of DARPA and advanced systems in the past decades. A project named Massive Digital Data Systems, the MDDS, was introduced. Universities were handed over control over the project. As IC demanded, Dr. Anita Jones, a scientist at the University of Virginia, became the director of DARPA. She had been on the board of directors at the Mitre firm since 1988, so she followed up on the project through Mitre. Huge finances were directly allocated to the best projects introduced. It gave a technological boost to Silicon Valley's tech companies. The most outstanding issue was a successful search engine to exactly find what they're looking for faster than other search engines. Professor Jeffrey Albin and his colleagues, who had previously worked with DARPA, referred two students to DARPA supervisors. They were really instrumental in ranking the pages: Sergey Brin and Larry Page. Brin and Page started their work with the funding for the Digital Library Initiative, the DLI, a multi-agency program sponsored by the National Science Foundation, NASA, and DARPA. Two intelligence directors were in charge of directing the program, and as the search was progressing, they held regular meetings with Brin. The funding by the NSA and CIA were indirectly transferred to their bank accounts and other projects. In their article in 1988, which was published in the Bulletin of the Technical Committee of the American Compute Society on Data Engineering, Page and Brin described page ranking methods and stated that the article was sponsored by the American Science Foundation. The amount awarded by the foundation was over $4.5 million. After a while, they unveiled Google. No one knew how it was related to intelligence agencies. In September 1998, two technology entrepreneurs invested $100,000 on Google each.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
Self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Welcome to another episode of the program, Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Hashimi Nejad. Please stay tuned.
Uwais
al-Qarani, one of the companions of Imam Ali alayhi salam, had a beautiful way of praying to Allah. He used to divide the nights of the week to different types of prayers. One night was called Laylatul Sujood. From early night up to early morning, he did all the prostration to Allah, saying, Subhana Rabbiyal A'la wa bihamdi. Yet another night was called Laylatul Ruku. Over that night, he only recited Subhana Rabbiyal Azim wa bihamdi. Another night was called Laylatul Qunut. He used to recite and pray to Allah to be free from the fire of the hell. Uwais al-Qarani used to prostrate during the night in the dark deserts up to an extent that the birds thought he is a piece of stone. They went to his back and were playing there, while he was still in prayer, without being distracted. This is how the true men of Allah pray. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Hashim Nejat. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In Britain, Prime Minister Rishi Sunak is under pressure over his claims about the state of dentistry, as figures reveal that the number of active NHS dentists in England is at its lowest level in the past decade. We take a look at the British media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Morning Star has covered this story and tells us more. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak must drop any pretense that the National Health Service dentistry is on the road to recovery and finally deliver a meaningful rescue package, the British Dental Association, the BDA, has warned as the exodus from the service reaches new heights. A Freedom of Information request by the British Dental Association, published on Tuesday, 23rd of May, reveals the lowest number of dentists available in a decade, in what the association called a reality check on months of misleading claims from the Prime Minister. The British Dental Association found that 23,577 dentists performed National Health Service work in the 2022-2023 financial year, down 695 on the previous year, and down over 1,100 on pre-pandemic numbers. It brings the workforce to levels not seen since 2012-2013. The figures are at odds with repeated claims from Rishi Sunak that recent reforms have boosted dentist numbers and arguments by ministers made to the current official inquiry into the crisis. Practices are struggling to fill vacancies, which means they face fines for not hitting their NHS contractual targets, according to the British Dental Association. It estimates that practices will have to pay back more than £400 million for not hitting their targets this year. The British Dental Association is calling for a new higher minimum unit of dental activity value, which it says could help stop dentists having to treat NHS patients at a loss. A minimum unit of dental activity value level of £23 was rolled out last October, lower than the current patient charge level of £25.80, and below the level required for most practices to cover their costs or attract new dentists into the profession, it said. The British Dental Association General Dentist Practice Committee Chairman Sean Charwood said, "Government needs to drop the spin, accept the facts and provide a rescue package to keep this service afloat. National Health Service dentistry is hemorrhaging talent and further tweaks to a broken system will not stem the flow." The Prime Minister once called for this budget to be ring-fenced. "We face an access crisis, and with hundreds of millions set to be pulled away, funds must be put to work solving these problems." Ministers have a choice. They can help thousands of struggling practices fill their vacancies and see patients, or just pass by on the other side. Toothless in England, the campaign group demanding an NHS dentist for everyone in England said, "Children, adults and the elderly are left hopelessly abandoned and forgotten by the National Health Service and the government. Patients who contact us are often in extreme pain. They're getting increasingly angered by the lack of accessible dental care in England." The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered the same story. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak is under pressure over his claims about the state of dentistry, as figures reveal that the number of active NHS dentists in England is at its lowest level in the past decade, leaving millions of people struggling to get checkups or have toothaches fixed. The British Dental Association, the BDA, has warned of an exodus of dentists from the National Health Service, as it published figures showing that the workforce has been reduced to a level not seen since 2012-2013. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has repeatedly said that 500 extra dentists had been recorded as providing NHS services in the 2021-2022 financial year. A growing number of dental surgeries do little or no National Health Service-funded work, with the British Dental Association citing a £3 billion dental budget that has failed to keep pace with inflation and population growth over the past decade. A total of 23,577 dentists performed National Health Service work in the 2022-2023 financial year, down 695 on the previous year, and according to a response to a Freedom of Information request from the NHS Business Services Authority. That figure is more than 1,100 down on pre-pandemic numbers. The loss of dentists within the system has led to nearly 6 million adults trying and failing to get a National Health Service dentist appointment in the past 2 years, according to a recent analysis by the British Dental Association. The official figures on the NHS dentistry workforce appear to contradict the Prime Minister's claims that recent reforms have boosted the number of dentists. The British Dental Association said it thought the Prime Minister was relying on a rise in activity from dentists in the National Health Service in the financial year 2021-2022 that had naturally followed the end of the COVID lockdown. Sean Charwood, who chairs the British Dental Association's General Dental Practice Committee, said, "The government needs to drop the spin, to accept the facts and provide a rescue package to keep this service afloat. National Health Service dentistry is hemorrhaging talent and further tweaks to a broken system will not stem the flow. The Prime Minister once called for this budget to be ring-fenced. We face an access crisis, and with hundreds of millions set to be pulled away, funds must be put to work solving these problems. Ministers have a choice. They can help thousands of struggling practices fill their vacancies and see patients, or just pass by on the other side. The British Dental Association, the BDA, has been asking ministers to recycle money returned to the government by dentistry practices that have been unable to hit their contractual targets. It is estimated this money could exceed £400 million this year. The fall in workforce numbers highlighted in the figures is also said by the British Dental Association to underplay the full scale of lost capacity in National Health Service dentistry. A recent British Dental Association survey of dentists in England revealed that half of dentists, or 50.3%, had reduced the proportion of National Health Service work they did by more than a quarter since the start of the pandemic. And 74% of the dentists indicated they plan to reduce the amount of NHS work that they undertake in the year ahead. The National Health Service Business Services Authority did not immediately respond to a request for comment. The Department of Health and Social Care spokesperson said the latest figures might be lower than the previous year due to not all NHS dentists having submitted their data for the last financial year. The spokesperson said, "We're working to improve access to National Health Service dental care and have already increased the funding that practices receive for high-need patients to encourage dentists to provide more National Health Service treatments." The Department of Health spokesperson added, "We have also amended the guidelines so dental therapists and hygienists can deliver more treatment, as well as making it easier to recruit dentists from overseas. And we will be setting out further measures to improve access shortly."
Why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim. Dini l-Islami dini wal-Azam ghayru dini Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We are going to talk about the rules of taqlid, or following a religious scholar, a jurisprudential scholar, according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
Mm-hmm. little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up till 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching, one can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Javed, hosting this program. Ashraf Javed, our guest speaker here. We are talking about the rules of taqlid based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Javed, let me start this episode with this question. You know, if you want to stop following a deceased mujtahid, let's say Imam Khomeini's, for example, fatwas, right?
Yes.
Is it obligatory for us, in fact, to refer to that mujtahid whose permission we obtain to continue following the deceased mujtahid, or may we refer to other mujtahids as well?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Caution or ihtiyat goes with reference to the fatwas of the mentioned mujtahid or the mujtahid whose permission you obtained when you to continue following the fatwa of the deceased mujtahid. Of course, if there is another mujtahid who is alive and who is the most knowledgeable person, and of course whose fatwa in the matter of changing one's taqlid differs from that of the first one, in such a case it is an obligatory precaution to refer to the most learned mujtahid. It's always, as we have discussed time and again, it's always mandatory to refer to the most learned mujtahid. Dead or alive, of course, if we refer to a dead mujtahid or if we follow a dead mujtahid, we need the permission of the most living and learned living mujtahid. And if we want to follow a living mujtahid, we always must turn to the one who is the most qualified and the most knowledgeable of all the mujtahids.
Sheikh Javed, is it permissible to change one's marja?
Changing one marja, you know, there are many people who wish to change their marja because they look for the fatwa.
Right.
And they try to compare one fatwa with another and the opinions of one mujtahid with those of the other mujtahid.
Yes.
And they try to find the one which is easier, mm-hmm. which is more practical. Right. And yeah. So this is, it's not permissible to change one's mujtahid without, unless there is a reason, an important reason. For example, if the mujtahid you are following is not qualified, and you come to know that he is not actually qualified to as a mujtahid,
right.
Then it becomes mandatory to change your taqlid and to shift to another mujtahid who is the most learned mujtahid.
Mm-hmm.
But changing one's taqlid unnecessarily and just as a, you know, as a gesture of, you know, your temperament, you think it is good to change one mujtahid. It's not something that you do it arbitrarily,
yes.
You know. So Ayatollah Khamenei actually says that it is an obligatory precaution not to change,
mm-hmm.
not to change from a living mujtahid to another living one, unless the latter is at least probably the most learned. So
mm-hmm.
probably, you know, that's the position.
Yes.
So if one is actually certain, there is no doubt about it, that it is that one has to shift to the most learned one.
I see.
Yes.
Okay, thank you very much. Let's take a short break and we'll be back very soon. And we continue our program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio. Stay with us.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/Ian. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah, don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are still talking about the rules of taqlid based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khomeini. Sheikh Javid, somebody asked, as a pious teenager, I used to follow one marja. This was before I reached the age of Sharia puberty, and my taqlid was not based on religious proof, but on conviction that following that certain mujtahid would discharge me of my obligations, religious obligation. After some time, I changed to another marja, but my changing was also invalid. Then I changed to another marja after the second marja passed on.
Yes.
What is the rule concerning my taqlid of that marja and my acts during that period in particular? What is my duty now?
Well, when it comes to the actions and deeds performed by this person or this duty-bound person,
yes,
with regards to following Imam Khomeini, may Allah bless him, His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khomeini says that such an individual's actions and deeds are valid. And of course, whether he followed the late Imam Khomeini before his demise or after his demise, his actions are in order. His prayers, his fasting, and all other deeds of or acts of worship are in order. But when it comes to changing and shifting to another mujtahid,
mm-hmm.
without taking care of the Shari standard, and without the taqlid being based on being grounded on Shari criteria or Shari standards, His Eminence says that if his taqlid happened to be in accordance with the fatwa of the most learned mujtahid, the A'lam, then they are valid, they are in order. But if his actions, the deeds he performed and did not happen to be in accordance with the fatwa of the most learned mujtahid, then he must repeat those acts, because they were not in accordance with the fatwa of the most learned mujtahid. He should repeat them.
Mm-hmm.
So, generally speaking, we conclude in a nutshell that it's always necessary to follow the most learned mujtahid, and there is no doubt whatsoever with regard that Imam Khomeini was, of course, may his soul rest in peace, was the most learned of all the mujtahids of his time, and whoever, according to all religious authorities, according to His Eminence, whoever followed him before his demise and after demise, his actions and his deeds are in order.
Mm-hmm. Sheikh, if some people have been following a certain marja since the late Imam Khomeini passed away, and now they wish to follow Imam Khomeini again, may they do so? Are they allowed to do so? I mean, is it permissible for them to go back to Imam Khomeini's fatwas?
That's a good question, because, this is, according to the opinion of the religious authorities, if you once followed a mujtahid and then you stopped following him and followed a living mujtahid,
yes,
and now you are regret why you changed your taqlid of the deceased mujtahid,
mm-hmm.
you wish to go back to the deceased mujtahid and follow him, continue mm-hmm. following him.
Yes.
The religious authorities have agreed that it's not permissible to move from a living mujtahid
to a deceased
mujtahid. And this is a matter of consensus.
So regression is not permissible?
Of course, it's not permissible. You cannot go back.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, you can continue following a deceased mujtahid, but you cannot move from a living mujtahid to a deceased one.
I see. Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you.
Thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. From me and the rest of the crew, we bid you farewell and we say wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
Rahman Rahim Mannan Kareem Salam Aleem Malajah Ilaha Illahum Ghaffar Jameel Wahhab Latif Tawwab Sami' Basir La Ilaha Illahum Rahim محيي المميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT5 and
Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.